Session number 21095, Reel 23.
Fallout. And so then I arrived at the United Nations, and of course sort of one of the great slogans that the Soviet Union in those days was promoting, and which found a lot of echo amongst the smaller countries, where the Soviet Union was calling for complete disarmament, and particularly of course nuclear disarmament. And that was debated year in, year out, and of course with the West, particularly the NATO countries, arguing this was totally unrealistic and made no sense at all. But it was a concept that was popular amongst certainly the non-aligned countries, any country that was not part of the two big power blocks. And there were endless debates about it, and every speech that was made by foreign ministers and heads of state when they came to the United Nations would always have a paragraph or two on the, when it came from any of the non-communist bloc countries, condemning the notion and rubbishing it and saying this was nonsense, and of course with the Russians always promoting it and saying it was just the West which was bent on destroying the world and so on and so forth. So that was something that one routinely looked at, and after a while I think I stopped reporting very much about it because it was very repetitive and clearly made no political sense. No one was prepared to negotiate on that basis, and it was perfectly obvious that the Russians themselves were not interested in doing that, but they found it a slogan that helped them in their relations with third world countries in particular. But of course against that there were the negotiations for extending the limit, for signing the limited test ban treaty, so that only underground testing would be permitted and no other forms of testing. I cannot recall the date when that was signed, and I have to look it up. I will do that for the next time. I was not directly involved in reporting that because those negotiations were taking place in Geneva at a time when I was still at the United Nations, to the extent that I can recall this. But I do remember that after I left New York and the United Nations reporting there and was transferred to Geneva, I continued to report on arms negotiations that were going on in Geneva. There was one negotiation that was sort of always in existence, and those were negotiations dealing with conventional weapons and particularly also with chemical and bacteriological weapons. And that is a theme that continued for a very long time, though of course the talks on conventional arms reductions eventually moved to Vienna. And again, I reported those ad infinitum. The reporting on the arms negotiations in various forms formed a thread throughout my whole reporting life at The Guardian until 89. With the fall of the wall, most of those negotiations came to a standstill, and interest in them diminished greatly. But for all those years during the Cold War, the arms negotiations really were a sort of shorthand for describing and discussing East-West relations. I mean, that was the one point of contact which was always kept open between the two sides. And the way those negotiations went told you a great deal about the state of the relationship between NATO and the Warsaw Pact countries. So this was always very significant. Some of it was extremely complex, obviously, and very, very difficult to explain to the average reader on the paper. And I found this a perpetual challenge, how to describe the state of play in the various negotiations, how to describe what the negotiations were all about and what they meant. One factor that made it marginally easier for me is that the Guardian's defense correspondent, David Fairhall, was a wonderful colleague to work with, and the two of us obviously talked a great deal about what we were about the arms talks, about the arms negotiations. But the main thing is that he left me free to describe the sort of political content of the negotiations, and he always backed it up with his extensive technical know-how. This meant that very often I would go to particular high-level meetings of arms negotiators. He would not necessarily come as well, but he would be in London backing up the information that I was gathering with, as I say, his know-how. And I think that worked extremely well, and I really cannot recall any disagreements, and I think that's pretty remarkable, because if he had been less willing to leave me to do this sort of interpretation of the political significance of what was going on, I think we would have had considerable difficulties, and not every paper managed this kind of partnership as well as I think we did on The Guardian. And I think we did provide a pretty comprehensive coverage of what was going on. Now, there were clearly all those arms talks divided into two sets. I mean, the one concerned nuclear weapons, and the other dealt with the conventional weapons issues. Of the two, the nuclear weapons negotiations were obviously more were much more interesting, and they're always very complex, but of supreme political importance. The conventional weapons negotiations were very difficult to describe, because they dealt with the nitty-gritty of the various components of conventional arms forces, where they were deployed, what the size should be, and they were always dominated by the assumption that Warsaw Pact forces were way much, much larger than NATO conventional forces. It turned out, of course, as we all discovered at the end of the Cold War, that a great many of these assumptions had been wrong, and that the Soviet armed forces had not been nearly as large or as well armed or as disciplined and well run as NATO had always claimed to justify its nuclear build-up in Europe, particularly with medium-range nuclear weapons. I always found it terribly hard explaining what was going on in Vienna, and from time to time I would go, because those negotiations were in session almost continuously. I mean, they had obviously had breaks, but I mean, they went on year after year after year, and there were interim agreements and more agreements and less agreement. But I can't recall all the details anymore. What I do recall is the sort of endless struggle I always had to try and sum up in the space that was available to me, not only what all those negotiations were all about, but also what progress, if any, was being made or not made. And the other problem about the conventional force negotiations, CFE as they were called, was that there were far more participants than in the nuclear arms negotiations, because that concerned primarily the Soviet Union and the United States, with Britain and France sort of tagging on somewhere. And again, that was a sort of perpetual issue, to what extent they were directly involved in those negotiations. But clearly, the conventional force negotiations, I can't remember how many countries were, but there were at least around two dozen involved most of the time. And of course, the communist bloc countries were negotiating as a bloc. The NATO countries were trying to negotiate as a bloc, but even so, individually, they had different things to say. And of course, the French were always hovering somewhere in the background, trying to do things differently. perhaps I should have said earlier on that sort of a linchpin of the coverage of all the various aspects of arms control were the NATO meetings. NATO met at foreign ministerial level twice a year. Usually those meetings were preceded by meetings of defense ministers. Now the way we did it is that my colleague David Fairholm would cover the defense ministers' meeting. I would always go to the foreign ministers' meetings. In December they were always staged in Brussels at NATO headquarters there. In June or whatever, in mid-term, every year, they alternated between different NATO capitals. So there was a degree of tourism involved in that, and some of it, those were interesting meetings, and it was always a great gathering of all the journalists who from all the various countries who covered these arms negotiations, and we would all meet together, and I think we all enjoyed those meetings. And at those NATO meetings, each country's foreign minister would always brief separately, and there was an endless debate because the British always said that they would not allow any foreign journalists into their briefings, and on the other hand, the Germans, for instance, always allowed me to go to their briefings because they knew me and because I spoke the language and so on, and one or two others also managed to squeeze their way in. Others would be able to go to the French briefings, but on the whole, we, the journalists, set up sort of our own bazaar and exchanged information about what we'd been told by our respective delegations. And, some of it, I suppose it's of greater interest to the journalist doing the work than to the reader at the other end, but we always had great difficulty. Every foreign minister always made speeches summing up their position on policy issues, and some of those speeches were important and interesting. The problem always was how to get hold of the text of those speeches, and on the whole, again, they either distributed it first to their own nationals and only afterwards to the others, or there would be a sort of unholy scramble when the speeches were put out on a table. Anyway, it was all good fun, and somehow we always managed to do our stories. And those were the sort of the biannual highlights of this coverage. And one of the things, of course, nowadays people warn about the disintegration of NATO as if it was a new concept. I mean, in fact, NATO at risk was a sort of perpetual theme. I mean, I'm sure that every journalist who ever covered NATO, sort of from the mid 70s onwards, at some stage wrote a story: a risk that Americans will withdraw their forces from Europe, or once more the Americans have come to NATO, reassuring them that they have no intention of withdrawing their forces. But then you would get into this sort of endless discussion: is NATO at risk? Are the arms negotiations threatening to break up the alliance? The presence of medium-range nuclear weapons in Germany, which I'll come to in a moment, which of course became a hugely important issue, is that putting the NATO alliance at risk? There were always problems. When the Gulf War broke out, when the Germans were so reluctant to contribute, I mean, they were not prepared to contribute personnel, but they also were very slow in any sort of financial assistance, participation in the sort of war effort. Again, the question was, can the NATO alliance sustain these kinds of strains? Then there would always be debates about out of area commitments for NATO with the Americans. During the Vietnam War, the Kissinger used to pressure the NATO allies for support in Vietnam, and they refused. And that was a perpetual issue, which now, in retrospect, has died. I mean, it is now accepted that NATO could go out of area under certain circumstances. In those days, it was absolutely unheard of. All right. Yes, all right. Where is it stopping now? out of area.
That it's accepted now that NATO does go out of
area,
but not at that time. Yes. You're going to say something about Germany, I think.
But I'm not. All right. Can we start again? Of course, it would not have been even conceivable in those days that Germany could ever agree to have its forces deployed outside the NATO area, as has happened later, as happened later in Kosovo and in Bosnia. But the NATO meetings were always really the sort of summation of the alliance's efforts to deal with the Soviet threat. And the Soviet threat throughout the Cold War, I think it's fair to say that those biannual meetings of NATO took the should be seen as the temperature gauge of the Cold War. And talking of temperature, I remember one meeting that was held in Scotland once, when it was so cold that everybody absolutely froze to bits, and the journalists had to operate in a tent that had been put up, and with chandeliers. And it was at Turnberry, and we had sort of little cubicles to work in, and we had to walk through a muddy field to get to it, and then there would be security before we were allowed in. And all the time we could see that the ministers themselves were in the Turnberry Hotel, which was sort of up the hill, some distance from us, and they would sort of come down to us to brief us and so on and so forth, and the telephones didn't work and so on. At that time, I was the president of the Diplomatic and Commonwealth Writers Association, and I remember we were all so infuriated by the way we'd had to sort of live over those 2 days in that freezing cold up at Turnberry, that we started negotiating with the Foreign Secretary, Douglas Hearne, saying, you know, he must never allow this kind of situation to occur again. And then we had our annual dinner in the Diplomatic Writers Association some while after that, and I remember announcing that we'd signed the Treaty of Turnberry to ensure better conditions, working conditions for journalists covering NATO meetings. But that was really one of the sort of sidelines of all these things. Another time we were in Reykjavik for a NATO meeting, as distinct from the famous Reykjavik summit, to which I will come in due course. But there it was rather different, because whenever we felt uncomfortable, so in Reykjavik, wherever you go, there are pools of hot water coming out of wells, out of underground springs, and you know, you can go and swim in those. So that was much better. But NATO loomed so large in my reporting life, and I think in a lot of other diplomatic journalists' lives. And what is interesting now is the whole NATO, the significance of NATO, the importance of NATO for the general reader, for newspapers, sort of diminished hugely after the fall of the war. And it's only more recently, when the debate about a European Rapid Reaction Force sprang up, this has all sort of come to life again. And again, it struck me how short memories are, because the notion of the European pillar, the third pillar, is sort of part of the theology of NATO, always has been, which went hand in hand with the American pressure for what they always call burden sharing. And the issue of a rapid European reaction force had been under discussion for years and years and years in the context of Western European Union, which was yet another vehicle for discussing arms issues, which again I always found extraordinarily difficult to write about, simply because it always seemed to me that WEU was an absolutely meaningless institution which served no particular purpose, though you know, every member would always tell you that it was very important. It had, it generated a certain number of political meetings. It certainly also generated quite a lot of military planning discussions and so on, no doubt. But I think much of what it did duplicated what was being done in NATO. And it seems rather ironic that now the Americans are warning that the European Rapid Reaction Force, its planning staff might duplicate what NATO was doing. Well, again, this is an old story. This is not a new story. And I think, you know, I'm sure that there are certain experts who will disagree with me, but I think that the European Rapid Reaction Force obviously has a political content in terms of European Union, which it didn't have to such a degree earlier on when this was sort of still linked to the notion of Western European Union and simply the European pillar and the burden-sharing concept. But the basic thinking behind it is exactly as it has been for some considerable period, which was for the Europeans to have access to certain force contingents that would be available to operate under circumstances where the Americans were not prepared to act. And that this would be done in consultation with the Americans was always understood, that the Americans always supported and, as far as I could tell, never really seriously tried to question this direction that the Europeans were trying to take. It seemed to me the problem always was to organize the Europeans into actually making good on what they said on paper they wanted to achieve. And so I think I'm always amazed by certainly my colleagues in the media who sort of suddenly create a huge issue as if it was something that nobody had ever dreamt of or thought about before, simply because they don't bother to look back and to do their research, and also because it sounds much sexier if you blow it up into a huge political issue without any reference to anything that might have gone before. But anyway, all I can say is I've written about the European pillar and rapid reaction forces and all the rest of it for many, many years.
Is it time, do you think, Hella, for you to write another article bearing in mind the situation today? Because this is not explained, is it?
But, you know, on the whole, it's very hard. I mean, I suppose, yes, one could find an outlet for it, but I think it would be quite hard to find an outlet for that where it matters. I think I'm quite surprised that amongst the more amongst the broadsheets, like, you know, for instance, the Financial Times and so on, which has always had immensely good coverage of defence issues and of security issues, that they haven't gone into that a bit. But it's, you know, it's always hard to say, you know, we've been there before, because you know, on the whole, once a political issue blows up, it's going to blow up, and no amount of saying, I've heard people say this, I've heard broadcasts saying, you know, this isn't the first time we've talked about and looked at all these things. But I think where the failure is, that the politicians, and particularly, I think, the Tony Blair's government, who after all does know the background, is trying to promote this issue, doesn't say this is just simply an elaboration of planning and discussions that go back to the previous government and so on. I mean, they ought to be doing it. But I think, I think one sees this very often with these rather delicate issues, that when the tabloids make a big meal of it, the government tends to defend it in terms of immediate concerns, and very rarely tries to put them into context. And I think I see this repeated over and over again. And, you know, you ask yourself why. But they don't. I mean, I'm sorry, this is really a digression, but the refusal of Tony Blair to take part in a party political debate, in political debates during the election campaign in 2001, I think, again, doesn't give the kind of justification that it deserves, which is that the American debates have shown that they create a totally distorted view of the politicians. Partly because these are not real debates; these are very carefully staged events. There is no real exchange of view, and the viewer is asked to concentrate much more on how the on the body language and the way they're dressed or whatever. But I mean, this is not the kind of debating that I would think justifies the term debate. And I think that's why Blair is right in doing it. Anyway, all I'm saying is they don't say that. And I think this, and you see that with many political issues, and certainly with the Rapid Reaction Force, I think the Blair government could have mounted a much better defense of its interest and moves towards the establishment of such a force, rather than allow themselves to be distracted by these endless debates about the breakup of NATO and so on and so forth. But anyhow, perhaps I should now go back to the nuclear arms negotiations, and because that was the sort of real meat of the Cold War, of the East-West relationship throughout the Cold War. They, in a way, acted as substitutes, surrogates for diplomatic negotiations about broader political issues. And it was only when the arms control negotiations proved successful, achieved certain results, that paved the way for bilateral negotiations on broader issues, most of the time. I mean, clearly, I'm not saying that diplomatic exchanges on other issues were at a standstill, while the superpowers negotiated on strategic nuclear arms, on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, or you name it, whatever. But certainly, those were the sort of major component of East-West relations, and that's of course why it was very interesting, but it was very challenging to, on the one hand, describe the political content of those negotiations, the political importance of those negotiations, while at the same time actually explaining what the technical issues were. And clearly I had to do quite a bit of that as well.